This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm DeWayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawaken.
This week, is your cell phone safe from unwarranted searches? A new ruling on mobile rebroadcasting of over-the-air video? Another major player enters the smart home market? A late-night show on Netflix? And all the best from Google's I/O Developer Conference. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription links are in our show notes. And if you do so, please leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the show. You can join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. And our show is on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into hot topics, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I just wanted to mention that I recently got, for Father's Day, Apple TV. So it's my first experience ever with Apple TV. And I have to say that I really enjoy it. It's very easy to use, very intuitive, up to a point. It's got all of most of the major services that some of the other over-the-air on set-top box devices that I have has, like Netflix, obviously, and Hulu. It's got HBO Go, although my particular cable provider does not allow Apple TV use of HBO Go.
Oh, that's tragic.
Yeah, yeah. They allow use on the iPad and my MacBook Pro, but not on specifically not on Apple TV. It's kind of weird.
You might be able to AirPlay it from your iPad.
Yeah, yeah.
Get reasonable quality.
That's the one thing, like, the AirPlay factor of Apple TV, it's interesting because there is a sort of a latency issue over the Wi-Fi that Chromecast sort of eliminates that by, you send the signal on Chromecast, and then it takes over on its own.
And talks directly to the service across the web.
Yes. And Apple TV does not do that. So if you want to mirror something that's going on your iPad or your iPhone onto Apple TV, you do have to deal with a little bit of a latency issue.
Yeah. It all depends. Like, I've set up my Wi-Fi network so that I've got a dedicated 5 gigahertz. Well, my Apple TV is actually wired in. Mm-hmm. And then my iOS devices are on 5 gigahertz. And almost every device I have is on 2.4 gigahertz, so it's not actually on the same network, which is pretty helpful. In fact, all of my embedded devices, like my Nest and my Fitbit Scale, that's all on a separate, completely different B network, just because the data that it's passing doesn't need to be on the on the high bandwidth stuff. So that's the only way I found to combat the latency.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great, but it gets it done.
But so I've been enjoying that a lot. We've got it hooked into the TV. Now we've got like two or three set-top box solutions that are hooked into the same TV. We got the Chromecast and the Apple TV and the Sony Blu-ray player with the cross-media sort of set-top box. It's the same sort of media server as the PlayStation 3 on there. So we've got many different roads that lead to the same
content.
Yes, the same content. So we're covered. But I like it. AirPlay is really sort of like the, I don't want to say it, but I'm going to say it, killer app.
Oh, don't say it! Don't say it!
Say it. I'm very curious now. I don't know what you're going to say.
Killer app. Because we had that conversation earlier offline about just the terminology of killer app. But I have a AirPlay amplifier, which I'd love using prior, but it didn't do anything for video. So this is a great way to incorporate the video into my AirPlay streaming. So
if you like AirPlay, here's what's perverted. You get your iPhone or iPad out. You set it on whatever streaming audio service you like. You have that AirPlay to the television set, so you get all the speakers working on that. And then you're in the kitchen cooking like I do, and you use your Pebble to change songs and skip through content and play and pause. Then you've basically got every protocol, every type of device working. It especially gets whack if you take your iPad or iPhone and you have it remote your iTunes library, and then you have that playing through the Apple TV while you're controlling it with your Pebble.
That sounds meta.
Yeah, it's meta. it's a mind job. It's perverted.
But that it can be done is really a testament to the state of the art of technology.
Exactly. Exactly.
Dwayne, how about you? What have you been playing with?
It's nothing much. So I try not to play too many games on my phone just because it's a battery sucker. It's a time waster, whatever. But I did find one that I really enjoy. It's fairly popular. It's called Two Dots. If you've ever played Tetris or Puzzle Fighter or anything, you'll get the idea almost immediately. And it's incredibly satisfying. And at the same time, if you die 5 times, it takes 20 minutes for each life to come back. Or it takes maybe 6 minutes for each life to come back. It takes an amount of time for each life to come back so that you're not going to sit there playing all day like I used to do with Subway Surfer or the Planes game I used to play. It literally kicks you off, so you're forced to be productive. Wow. And you forget about it until, you know, you see the icon again and you pop it open and boom, you're there and you're playing it one more time. And it's great. And it's, you know, it's got the whole problem-solving thing. It's got all that. And it's beautiful. So it's cute. So, yeah, if you have a chance, look up Two Dots and, play with that. It's on iOS.
All right, Two Dots. I will look out for that. All right, let's get into some of our hot stories of the week. This week, the Supreme Court struck a dramatic blow against Aereo. And just to remind our audience, Aereo is the service that takes over-the-air content. It takes transmissions from over the air and restreams them for mobile customers via a tiny little antenna that they provide you, and you rent the antenna and that allows you to receive the over the air broadcasts from
via the internet.
Yeah. And there was a huge fight between Aereo and major content providers over whether this is legal, whether the Aereo service violates Copyright Act. And Aereo was clear about, no, our service doesn't violate the Copyright Act. We're doing everything legally. But Supreme Court shut them down in a 6-3 ruling today. Aereo had argued it was merely providing technology that its subscribers were renting in order to watch TV. This is one of the most important rulings for the television industry since the 1984 Betamax case, which we
discussed last week.
Yeah, we just discussed last week Betamax versus VHS. But in many ways, this will have an opposite effect, stifling one area of innovation that was beginning to force the industry out of its comfort zone. Some broadcasters even threatened that they would open their own Aereo competitors if the service was found to be legal. Instead, this ruling fully removes Aereo and any other copycat services like this as a threat.
Yeah, I mean, this is pretty interesting. Basically, the Supreme Court said that whatever differences that are there, those differences concern not the nature of the service that Aereo provides, as so much as the technological manner in which it provides the service. Those differences are not adequate to place Aereo's activities outside of the scope of copyright. So basically, Aereo had been saying, look, we're not outside the scope of copyright. All we're doing is rebroadcasting. Yeah. But the fact that they were taking data and pushing that data onto a system and then giving different people access to that system, access to that data, is not the same as simply time shifting. When you time shift, you're getting the data. You know, the data is normally coming in from your antenna, and you're watching. You can watch it anytime you want, and then later, you know, you can also watch the same data that came into the antenna on something that recorded it. Aereo is taking data from an antenna, and it's actually pushing it through these systems so that you can get it where you may not be able to have good antenna service. And that's part of the problem there. The 6-3 ruling, normally we hear a lot about 4-5 ruling, you know, the four, yeah. five guys, the conservative side, the four guys on the liberal side. 6-3 is considered definitive in this day and age. So I don't suspect that this will be coming back to the court. This isn't a contentious or close reading ruling. People were behind this. This is something that Aereo is not going to be able to just quickly bounce back from. And given that the CEO said he has no backup plan, it's going to be interesting to see how they pivot. I don't know that Aereo will just shut down. I think that they might try to find options, loopholes, to maintain some level of their service. It's just unclear. So, yeah, I think this is definitely a big blow. But on the other hand, I think you have some good news for us from the Supreme Court.
So just one question here. Yeah. Do you think that that's going to affect any net neutrality, or do you think it's going to
– It's completely separate. It's completely and utterly separate. It does not touch the net neutrality piece at all.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it clearly is, but, you know, I wonder the type of focus on people trying to do things external to – but, yeah, no, I mean, I guess you win some, you lose some coming up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I was really curious to see how the industry would have been affected if Aereo had won their case. And they seemed fairly confident that they were going to win.
Well, they'd won before was the thing. It wasn't like they were appealing because they didn't like a ruling that came out of the Federal Circuit. Federal Circuit pulled out that Aereo was fine. But the Supreme Court basically put the kibosh on that ruling and said, no, it's not fine. And that's where I think the surprise came from. And I think that's where, as technologists, as technocrats, we're probably a little less happy with the fact that we're at least, you know, it wasn't a pleasant surprise, given that the technology is not going to move the industry forward. In fact, the legacy technology is going to keep the industry in the exact same place.
That sound you heard was a million cackling, gleeful laughs of big content owners.
So where do you think Aereo goes from here? Do you think they are,
like I said, I don't know. I think they're going to try to find some loopholes surrounding rebroadcasting, seeing if they can get something, a similar service using the technology in a different way to provide. Or maybe they'll break down and say, hey guys, what do I got to do to compete? What kind of copyright licensing fees do I have to shell out in order to get the service to work because people want it? Will Aereo's support base want to pay more money? Because Aereo is going to be less profitable than it will be if it's going to use the same existing fee base to get that data. So that's all stuff that's going to have to be decided. I can see Aereo not quite shutting down, but definitely pivoting in another direction. If time has showed us anything, the long arc of history of the universe, you know, bends toward both moral justice and technological justice. So I think that we'll see something. I mean, people want this tech. People want it. And Apple, as you can see, we talked about the Apple TV just now, they figured out how to get big content on their box. Obviously, they're Apple. They've got a lot of sway. They're the most, you know, they're the wealthiest company in the world. But, you know, they've gotten it so that you can get ABC, you can get Disney, you can get all these different big content providers. I guess those are the same content providers, but you can get MLB, you can get all these different content providers on that Apple TV set-top box. So, and with the whole Cable Anywhere initiative, you can get cable through the internet. There's got to be a way to for Aereo to figure it out from a business perspective. And if not, the technology will go into the bucket, and just like web TV 15 years ago, it'll show up again when someone else figures out.
Also, I wouldn't soon count out Barry Diller, who's the CEO of one of the Aereo's major investors. This is the guy who created the Fox Network.
Mm.
So I'm sure he's got something up his sleeve.
Yeah. I mean, people were behind this. It's the wave of the future.
All right, moving on here. You were alluding, Dwayne, to good news from the Supreme Court, and that is that prior to today, police needed a police did not need a warrant to search your cell phone, but the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that now police do need a warrant to search cell phones of people who have been arrested, with the exception of special circumstances.
Yeah, those would include things like there's a bomb about to go off or whatever, and they have definitive evidence that that's the case.
Civil libertarian groups argued that advances in technology mean that the rights of individuals to be, quote, secure in their persons, houses, papers, or effects, as guaranteed by the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, mean that police should seek warrants before rifling through suspects' mobile devices, and the government had countered that those same technological advancements aid criminals, that remote wiping and encryption could be used to destroy or conceal evidence of serious crimes. Yet the Supreme Court was unanimous in its judgment. A cell phone search would typically expose to the government far more than the most exhaustive search of a house, said Chief Justice Roberts. A phone not only contains digital form many sensitive records previously found in the home, it also contains a broad array of private information never found in a home in any form unless the phone is. So, good news, I guess, for civil rights.
It's really good news for anyone. I mean, here's the thing. You know, we were on the other day with the writer and publisher of Think Tank, and he mentioned that, you know, he's for the government being able to hop into your stuff and see your stuff because you shouldn't really have anything to hide. But the fact is, even if you have nothing legally to hide, being secure in yourself, being secure in your person, knowing that what you have to say, what you've written down in your papers, on your phone, whatever, that is a cultural thing. There are plenty of ideas that we all have that aren't ready for prime time, and we're still cultivating them. And if those are exposed to the government in such a manner that they're able to, you know, perhaps discredit you later on, God forbid that the government goes and moves in a petty direction or whatever, or just expose them so that your personal affairs fall apart. These are things that get in the way of progress and of general freedom. The ability to innovate largely comes from the fact that you can make mistakes. And we're in a society where even though we're all over social media and everything, we still edit ourselves somewhat before it gets out there. And the fact that we're able to do that now and not have to worry that being stopped for a speeding ticket could expose what might be considered a radical belief of yours is a good thing. You know, if a cop can't search your car without reasonable suspicion, or, you know, he can't just walk into your house and go into your garage and check out the insides of your vehicle where there's lots of data on how you've driven, what you keep in your trunk and everything. The idea that they can hold in your cell phone, which is, you know, connected to everything that you are, it just makes sense. And it makes so much sense that, again, in a very divided judicial atmosphere in the Supreme Court, this vote was unanimous. I think Tosin, he asked about net neutrality in relation to the last story. I think the bigger issue in relation to this story is when we look at what the NSA is capable of doing, the FISA court and everything, from that wider issue, this might give us some perspective as to how the judicial branch of the government views the ability to just randomly – seemingly randomly look in on the internal affairs of an individual. This is going to be used as precedent. This is going to be used as precedent in those kinds of cases.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, moving on here. So New York-based invention machine Quirky, a company which turns crowdsourced ideas into real-world products you can buy, like flexible power strips, e-connected milk jugs and egg cartons, and I think Dwayne, you
yes, I have an e-connected egg carton,
and you have glowed about it before.
I anti-glowed about it. luckily, they replaced it for me, so it's working now. But definitely, these guys are smart. They're on they both attack the fringe of what geeks might want. And things that geeks have been aching for whatever for a long time, because they're able to take ideas, talk to their partners who are in the creation of stuff and make them happen. Like the GE connected air conditioner.
Yep.
That's a quirky device.
We've talked about that.
$300. Yeah, we talked about that on the drill down. So yeah, these guys are bringing, you know, in some cases they're bringing smart stuff like the things we've talked about. In another case, they're bringing clever stuff like a way to take the tops off of cherries without having to take out a knife, bend over cherries, get a cutting board out and all that stuff. You know, to, I'm sorry, tops off of strawberries and right. just other kind of like just useful household devices.
Right. So they're what they're doing is they're venturing further in the smart home space with a spin out of a separate company they're calling Wink, according to a profile in the New York Times. They're going to focus on connected devices, which is, as we've discussed in the show before, wireless enabled products that can communicate via the internet with other services, as well as apps running on your smartphone. They've lined up 15 companies who will offer 60 Wink-enabled products by July, including GE, Honeywell, Philips, and startups like Ratio. GE has also chosen Wink as its preferred connected platform. That's huge.
Yeah. I can't stress enough how awesome this is for both Quirky and the general public. The connected era, these smart, these let's call them connected devices because smart is almost a different thing. These devices are things that people have just kind of been questioning and wanting to experiment with. Without these big companies getting behind it, you can't really get traction and move it forward. What's going to incent these big companies? Kickstarter-like programs where they know that people are behind the product even before it's available. And Quirky did a very good job of laying that out and showing the value of these types of things to GE, to Honeywell, and to these other guys. And when I remember when Quirky was first showing up, people kind of like, how are you going to make money? What are you doing? What's up with these random inventors? How are you going to put it together? And I think they've shown that if you have the will, you can take great ideas, take that IP, get it to manufacture, and then go back to the people who had those ideas and give them real profits. Because it's one thing to think about an idea. It's another thing to make that idea happen. Quirky's really done that. And the Wink application, that as a platform, that is the application used for all of your Quirky devices right now. So if you have the air conditioner, if you have the egg minder, if you have any one of these connected things, you're using the Wink app in order to control them. And it's got a very unique, interesting way of connecting. It's not a lot of typing in codes or whatever. It's pretty awesome. So the fact that GE's like, hey, look, you guys have figured that out. Why am I going to go reinvent the wheel? This is a great thing for anyone who likes connected. And I think they're a big enough draw. I mean, 60 products by July 31st, that is a lot of frickin' products. And usually the price points on these things are hanging out between the 30s and the 70s. With some good margins there. So Quirky has moved from a kind of fringe, okay, that's interesting, to a real player in the connected space. And I think SmartThings, Revolve, Philips, all these guys are going to have to look at Quirky, Wemo and Falconside, and they're going to have to jump in there and say, okay, these guys are legitimate competitors. And the innovation on the Quirky side, because they're crowdsourced, is going to get in the way of some of these other guys' plans.
I love the fact that they've got this unified app, that's going to be controlling all of these devices, because it reminds me of, remember, I think we discussed this on a few episodes back about how I wish there was something like this, and there was that third party service that you had talked about, that kind of does that. It's kind of the Harmony remote for unconnected smart home devices and services.
Yeah, the Revolve Hub. That's right. It's out of Boulder. Yeah.
But this is actual one protocol that will interoperate with all of these devices.
Exactly. And if Quirky's smart, they're gonna grab that IP. That API from Apple with the HomeKit. They're gonna grab. They're gonna try to work their best and get that Nest stuff all worked in. And they may even go to Revolve and say, "Hey, let's work with you," because that way. When this stuff opens up, the idea is if we have a standard and we have like a series of platforms, people can go out and get whatever they want and make it work for them instead of having to commit to one operating system or another, having to sort of like choose to silo themselves into one thing or another, which I think has been the standard for some time, but it's really breaking away on both the smart home and the general mobile space.
In related news, Nest Labs, which Google recently acquired for $3.2 billion, is opening up its Smart Nest thermostat and smoke detector to developers as part of a bigger effort to make them compatible with other web-connected household items like washing machines, garage doors, lights, and even cars.
Woo!
Yeah, this news comes right off the heels of Apple talking about HomeKit launching their own protocol for developers to act as a software hub for web-connected products. In addition to the Nest acquisition, Google's also in the process of buying webcam company Dropcam. So in many of these cases, the Nest thermostat will act as a main hub to connect all smart products in the home. This sounds just like the story we just read about Wink. So
exactly. I think we're seeing a convergence, and we talked about this a few years ago when all these cutting the cord devices began to show up, and they were only the province of people like us. We're seeing this now with the smart home, and when we talk about new product categories being opened up, this is what we're talking about. Talk about open. Yeah. Revolve has been hacking the Nest API for the last year and a half. Now they actually get access to it. The Nest API wasn't available during WWDC, so when they showed a smart thermostat, they used the competing Honeywell thermostat, even though everyone knows that if you like Apple, you're going to like Nest. Some of the same DNA there. Google opening this up just goes to show that, you know what, we're going to be in this space too, and it's going to be nice and competitive, and take whatever, bring your own device. Take whatever you have and connect it up. It's up to you, the developers, to get it connected to our various systems. And, you know, the more systems you connect to, the more people are going to buy. This is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you can definitely see that this is the direction that we've really been discussing a lot, you know, the moving towards APIs, right? Open APIs, allowing an ecosystem to develop around your app.
The guy from Box.
Yes, definitely says the guys from Box. And I think that's kind of, you can clearly see that's the current wave that we're in. And, you know, you suck in both users who are interested in the experience as well as developers, and that really, you know, that takes it up another level that you had never really saw back in, say, the early 90s or even the early 2000s. So
yeah, I mean, especially because for so long things have been, I don't know, it's kind of like gentrification. You go to like a certain neighborhood and they say the neighborhood is opening up. What does that mean? It means that different types of people are interested in living there than the people who normally live there, for better or for worse. In this case, it's definitely for better, because a lot of individuals are not going to jump in and buy a SmartThings hub, because they're like, well, what does SmartThings make? Are those the things I really want? Do I want to buy all that stuff? I like this other thing from this other guy over here. And the fact that these big companies like Google and Apple and GE are going to basically say, hey, look, bring whatever you got to us, means that someone like, you know, my fiance can say, oh, I can buy that and it's going to work with our stuff, as opposed to, oh, is it compatible? Is it Z-Wave? Is it, you know, Zigbee? Is it blah, 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 inside baseball nonsense crap, you know? And that's really what's going to make it a big deal. And Dropcam, I mean, everybody loves Dropcam. The devices are not cheap. Maybe Google can help the price come down a little bit because they're so big. But, you know, if you could Dropcam in a couple places in your home, you can watch your cat do anything, and that's really what I want. You know, while this stuff is, you know, for people who are geeky, whatever, I really feel like we're looking at the smart home. There's a great article in the WSJ where they question smart home. No, I'll keep my dumb one for now because I don't know what's up. Very entertaining article, but one of the things I look at when I see the smart home and I see the naysayers is that it's not that it's about the connected or smart home. It's about the fact that this is the way the world's going to be. Just like how you have internet-connected devices in your hand and you walk around with your phone every day, and no one thought that was possible 20 years ago, in 20 years or so, everything's going to be connected via Wi-Fi or whatever the protocol is then. When you buy your crock pot, when you buy your stove, your washing machine, whatever, the ability to monitor that stuff and, you know, again, move in this world that's the quantified self, that's going to be there. Everything, you know, like we were talking about the appliances a couple months ago, because you got a new appliance, Andy. And one of the things, you know, you got to realize is that in the future, the companies want it this way. You know, Microsoft saying that the Xbox has to be connected all the time has as much to do with Microsoft as it has to do with you. And it's going to be that way for everybody once they get their act together and they realize they can diagnose their electronic stuff and figure out, like, usage data and all that stuff. It's all going to be connected.
Okay, and Dwayne, Here's one headline that you brought to my attention about an initiative that Starbucks is taking for their employees.
Yeah, so, you know, Starbucks, as you mentioned before the show, Andy, they, you know, they're pretty forward-thinking. Back in 1989, they started giving health insurance to even their part-time employees. But they've done something pretty interesting. They're working with Arizona State University. This is a real large college in Arizona, large university. And they're taking their 135,000 employees and telling those employees that if those employees would like to take classes online at Arizona State University, it's possible, and it's possible on their dime. The partners, we call them baristas, but Starbucks calls them partners.
Right.
They hop online, they do their application form, whatever, and Starbucks is going to foot the entire bill for junior and senior years. And they're going to give some assistance for freshman and sophomore years. Now, why do it the other way around? Data shows that if you give people assistance in the first couple years, it's likely that they may not finish. It's not that they will necessarily not finish, but there's far more incentive to say that I tried, I couldn't get it done. But if they've put in some money for those first 2 years, knowing that they're going to get those last 2 years finished, two things happen. One, they're incentivized to get it done. And two, you as a company are in a position to explain how many people you helped graduate college definitively. Not how many people started college, not how many people took college classes, but how many people you helped graduate college. And the graduation of college is what Starbucks wants for a couple of reasons. One, they want people to graduate college and then join Starbucks in a possibly different capacity. Two, Starbucks alumni out there making more money in the real world are going to drive more usage of Starbucks. They can afford it. And three, Starbucks looks at rising costs of tuition and stuff and understands that a society made on underemployed people isn't going to thrive. And this is one of the things they can do to help. It's not a perfect system, but the idea that Arizona State University and Starbucks can come together on a bulk rate for 135,000 people is a pretty big deal. And I think it gives a lot of credence to online degrees. I think in the last 20 years, we've seen two things that a lot of people are pretty uncomfortable with happen online, relationships and college degrees. And I think that most people have gotten over the hump of online dating. Now getting over the hump of online college degrees as real degrees is something that's going to have to happen. And what's really interesting is that they're not just spending the money on people going, taking classes, doing homework and submitting it. They're spending money on advisors and other personnel that can help people who are taking these classes, who have problems or whatever, get through them. And this doesn't just apply to full-time Starbucks people. This applies to those people that are working 20 hours a week or more. So there's still enough time to get the work done. And to me, this is one of those socially responsible things that, you know, shows the power of online, because they couldn't do this with a million different colleges all across the country in local areas, and the power of, you know, big companies and big data.
It cements Starbucks' place as one of the top employers of retail.
One of the most connected employers, too. They are light years ahead of any other regular restaurant when it comes to CRM based on your mobile device. Light years ahead. Yeah. And this kind of idea... you know, using online to fuel growth in both people and the company is something that's never lost in Starbucks. They are innovators. I mean, you can't get to where they are without innovating offline with the whole coffee and how to get it to everybody and how to make it consistent, all that stuff. And online with what they've been doing with the Starbucks phone app and working with Square and all that stuff. So, you know, these guys got it.
All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book we'd like to recommend this week in honor of what we're going to be talking about after this break is In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives by Stephen Levy. Few companies in history have ever been as successful and as admired as Google, the company that has transformed the internet and become an indispensable part of our lives. How have they done it? Veteran technology reporter Stephen Levy was granted unprecedented access to the company. In this revelatory book, he takes listeners inside Google headquarters, the Googleplex, to explain how Google works. We've recommended this book before, and it's a popular book, and it provides a lot of insight into Google, the internal workings of one of the most recognized brands in history. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting because you look at this book, and it was finished in 2011. It's 2014 now. You know, it took a little while to write. You know, about a year and a half, and that was a time in which Android was in its infancy.
Yeah.
But a lot of what the thinking was behind where they wanted Android to go was necessarily, you know, architected, designed at that time and through the following years. What we see in Android today during Google I/O 2014 has a lot to do with how Stephen Levy has laid out Google's vision and how they come to certain conclusions. So this book is pretty helpful if you're interested in figuring out how Google is getting where they are, like how they arrive at the conclusions and how they decide to move in different ways from Apple. You know, Apple is focused on this continuity thing. Apple's focused on HomeKit and stuff. And Google, you know, there's similar services that Google's going to put forth in I/O 2014, but these services are different in material ways, not because Google wants to show differentiation just because, but because they think about these problems in a unique way. And I think it's a way that has gotten them from 0 to 60 in the last 10 years, 15 years, whereas Apple's gotten from 0 to 60 in the last 30 years, if you think about it. Google is a young company. It's barely older than Facebook, and its footprint is humongous. So definitely a good book. And if it's 19 hours. So if you use the Audible trial that Andy's about to describe, you're going to get a lot of book for no money. So worth checking out.
Yeah, so if you want to download that audiobook today or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial. Using that URL helps our show out. Even if you don't like Audible, even if you've decided you don't like the renewable service of Audible, you can cancel it, and you get to keep that book for free. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Google's got some big things on the horizon for the coming year. So take a listen to this, and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. So 2 weeks ago, we discussed Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, and this week, Google held its own developer conference, Google I/O, at Moscone Center in San Francisco.
The same place that Apple held its WWDC.
Yep. I thought it looked familiar.
Yeah.
They had a lot of stuff to discuss for developers, a lot of stuff associated with not only development, but also devices. But Dwayne, you wanted to kick off our discussion with the giveaway that they were handing out as people walked out the door.
Yeah, so they... They gave away, you know, every year Google gives something away. 1 year it was One year it was, you know, an Android device. One year it was the Chromebook. Another year it was that kind of Chrome Nexus thing that was $300 for like a basically an audio streaming device. Nobody liked that. But this year, we gave away a lot of stuff. They gave away Google's new Chrome, their new Cardboard, which is basically an inexpensive VR set that you could build at home if you want, but you put it together out of cardboard and most of the electronics they supply. And then they gave away a smartwatch, a square one. That's either going to be made by Samsung or LG. And then they also said they'd give away the Motorola round smartwatch, the Motorola 360, once that becomes available. So everybody there walked away with three things.
I know so many people there. Jealous.
Yeah, it's a thing. And I mean, like, granted, you know, the cardboard is a lot like glass. They haven't really figured out what to do with it yet. But, you know, it's cool anyway. They're still working on it.
But the cardboard thing is interesting because it was it's basically a 21st century stereoscope.
Yes.
You know, you put your Android device, your Android phone into the cardboard holder and hold it up to your eyes. It reminded me a lot of the either last week or the week before, I can't remember, we discussed Samsung's pairing with Oculus to build essentially the same sort of thing where you place the Samsung phone into a molded, plastic molded
Oculus. A viewfinder, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, well, this is, you know, Oculus is putting their name on it, and it does have some embedded electronics in it. But essentially, it's a 21st century stereoscope. And here is Google doing it super low tech. You know, you punch out the cardboard and assemble it yourself.
It's got. I'm just supposed to show Google's not willing to not. Google's willing to try anything.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the zeitgeist says VR is a thing. They're like, well, I'm not going to go full bore and put VR together in a second. But, you know, we have these phones, and Android is good at this kind of thing. You know, Samsung has already done it. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, Samsung was planning to do it. You know, this kind of thing didn't come up overnight. They've been planning this for a while. And in that same vein, they were like, what if we just made it out of cardboard? And that's kind of great. So I think it's pretty innovative use of the technology. We all have so many electronics. We all have so many things that are first gen, second gen, that are just sitting in a drawer, you guys especially. And the idea that you can use your phone to get this kind of thing done with some cardboard, like a large pizza box, that's pretty cool. So everyone received the Google Cardboard, and that's what happened. And they received either the Samsung or the LG smartwatch.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about some of the other things that they announced. They made an announcement of a new visual standard for material design. So so in essence, this is a part of their design language that will allow interfaces to be to be able to be more interactive and more basically will allow it to interfaces to also appear like they're lifting off the page to give sort of a point of reference for perspective based interfaces.
Yeah, this is you know, Google, when it came out with Ice Cream Sandwich, you know, they had worked very hard to get a unified visual standard, put some soul into Android. It wasn't just willy-nilly all over the place. They've continued to refine that. And when I look at material design, it's reminiscent of a lot of what you've seen on Android. It's just been codified in a way that allows for that flatness that you expect from Android and that iOS 7 made use of, but also to have a certain tactile nature as well. So when you touch something, it will move on or off the screen depending on how you did it. And the uniformity in which they're doing this and the fact that they're taking these standards and they're opening up them up to all the other developers means that when you're on this device and the Android devices that make use of this, you'll have a relatively unified feeling. Android will, you know, they've been working and working, but Android will finally kind of have this sort of coalescence into you know, a unified standard that it's going to feel and look a certain way, and I think that's going to be pretty tight. And it's a very mature way. Everything about I/O this year has seemed to be about maturity when it comes to Android, and that's what makes it pretty exciting. And this material design, it does have this weird tactile feel to it, even though it's incredibly flat. It's
kind of weird. Yeah, you know what's weird about that is that we have gone in mobile device UI, we have gone from this skeuomorphic sort of feel to a to the where everything sort of naturally looks like it's lifting off the page, or that it's something that you can touch that is 3D in your real world. And I'm talking about like stitched edges and torn pages. And we went from that to the complete like polar opposite, which is flat, flat, flat. And now we're seeing this weird almost sort of bounce back where, yes, it's flat, but we're also seeing these flat elements lift off 3D off the surface.
They have their own digital life with its own digital universe and physics to it. So it's like digital native, but it's still relatively tactile, which is pretty impressive. They've been working on this for a while. I think it's going to be a big hit, especially among developers who are so focused on getting the application to behave a certain way that often, you know, some of those visuals fall by the wayside without the good guidelines. If the guidelines are there, they're going to use them. And I think they know that it's going to help sell more phones.
Yeah.
And sell more apps.
Yeah, so this is also reminds me a little bit of the material design reminds me a little bit about of what we saw from Apple's WWDC with the I'm thinking about the announcement that we saw that we talked about last week about the Amazon Fire Phone, where the Fire Phone had these sensors that allowed the UI to shift in perspective with the way you're looking at the phone, and the material design sort of protocols that they're setting the standard for in this new version of Android is will help establish cues to allow Android developers to do the same thing with their phones.
Yeah, I mean, human interface is still a big thing, and since we left physical keyboards behind for the most part when it comes to mobile, everyone's still working hard to figure out a way, and I'm glad that there's like a lot of competition out there. You know, BlackBerry's haptic feedback hasn't really worked, but everything else, you know, between swipe and you know, this material design and iOS 7 and, you know, what's going on with Amazon, there's a lot of competition out there, a lot of different ways of knowing, and I think that's going to be, in the end, it's going to be great for the consumer.
Android One, I think I missed that announcement. What was that one about?
So Google understands that they have 700 million devices out there. They've got, you know, devices on every continent, but they don't have devices in the hands of the developing world, of, you know, the extreme poor of the world. So Android One is a reference platform for hardware that works with Android L, the new version of Android, in order to have developers create devices that are less expensive than the current devices and can reach these guys without losing a lot of the performance that you would expect from a more high-end device. Is it a high-end Android device? No. But what it is the ability to get smart devices in the hands of people all around the world, from, you know, the favelas of Brazil to you know, the ghettos of Kinshasa. And this is one of those things that they're working on in order to get more phones into more people's hands. We've seen this kind of movement in both Facebook and Google's work when it comes to the initiatives to get internet everywhere. Google's saying, I want to get these phones everywhere, and I want you, Samsung, Huawei, ZTE, you know, LG, all you guys, to have a reference in which you can put together a quick phone, a less expensive phone, and get that done. Because right now, Nokia is still dominating the developing world, and they're not doing it with smartphones. They're doing it with what we would now call dumb phones. And the more people connected, the more information being sent back and forth, the better the world is for everybody, especially Google.
Android L. So it wasn't just me. I thought that I had missed what dessert name that they were going to give the next iteration of Android that they announced today. But no, they didn't at all.
That's true. They, you know, every year and even every once in a while, in addition to years, a new version of Android has come out, whether it's a point revision or a full number. And Google has done a great job of getting people excited about it by naming it after a dessert. Ice cream sandwich, Kit Kat, all these different things. Gingerbread from back in the day.
You could see the statuary outside of the Googleplex of all the previous iterations of...
And exactly. And as a promotion, they put together a statue. They have costumes. You know, this is what they do. But again, this year, 2014, has been about the maturity of Android. It is a mature platform. Sober, I would say, from sort of the glee that it experienced before. And it's not to say it's not fun. It's just a sober and mature platform. And they're really expressing that. Mm-hmm. Maybe this has something to do with the leaving of Vic Gokhandotra.
Right.
You know, as the person who kind of presented everything at I.O. and kind of set the tone. But Android L is the version after KitKat. So if KitKat is K, L has come out. They're still not just numbering Android. They're using letters, which makes you wonder what happens when they hit the 26th version of Android. Is it going to be AA? You don't know. But Android L has a slew of new functionality, but we're going to highlight the big points for you.
If you were to still use the old nomenclature, what dessert would you name L after?
Lemon meringue, baby.
I was going to say...
You're one of those guys.
I actually hate lemon meringue, but I love the way it sounds when you say it.
Tosin, how about you?
Yeah, you know what? I don't know. I'd have to look up more desserts to start with L.
Yeah.
You got lemon drops? I'm into lemons. I like lemons.
Lemon drops could totally be it.
Yeah, you can suck on them, get that sweet and sour at the same time. That's good shit. So they've done a couple interesting things. Unified multitasking. The way multitasking is handled is with a wheel. They've got like basically a wheel icon that will help you move back and forth between the various things that you move to. Chrome has the same thing with its tabs. It's this wheel now. If you're holding an Android, if you're wearing an Android Wear device or you're in your Android Auto vehicle, which we'll talk about in a moment, you won't need a passcode to get back into your phone because it recognizes that it's in basically your domicile. That Android Wear device is you. It represents you. So why have to put that code back in? It's pretty clever.
Yeah.
Synergy. That's part of that. A remote kill switch. iOS has for a long time allowed you to wipe your phone clean if you've lost it. Android now allows you to do that. It's interesting because Android was one of the first to allow you to buy an app or a song or whatever content on the store on the web and have it automatically delivered to your phone. iOS had to chase that with iCloud and iOS 5. But now they're picking up the iOS functionality, being able to take everything off your phone remotely, which is key, especially in an age where I think both Android and Google are working hard to make people feel secure in their mobile existence, even if this Supreme Court thing hadn't been passed about checking out your phone. And finally, interactive notifications, bells and whistles. Samsung, HTC, you know, HTC Sense and Samsung's UI, they've had interactive notifications for a while. It's now completely native to Android, and that's a good thing. We're in a space where now the patent wars are pretty much died down. These guys, Apple and Google, are just kind of neck and neck with features. You'll feel comfortable in almost anything because you'll be able to find the same level of functionality.
Android Auto. So Android Auto is Google's protocol for working with automotive partners, and they're launching Android Auto for use with manufacturers. Some of their partners are Acura, Alfa Romeo, Audi, Bentley, Chevy, Chrysler, Dodge, Honda, and youth brands like Kia.
Their demonstration was really funny. They couldn't get a car on stage for obvious reasons. They got the engineers to cut out the interior of a Kia and put it on stage. So they had a virtual vehicle on stage. The seats, the head unit, the dashboard, everything there. And they had Android Auto installed. We're not looking at Google in the car. This is Android Auto. They're going all in the brand of Android, right? They're going all in on that because, again, Android is mature and it's ready for prime time, and there's no reason to tie, you know, mess around with Google this, Google that. We see the word Google in front of almost everything, but not here. This is Android Auto, and it is using the same SDK, a modified SDK of Android, what you normally use to develop apps for the phone. And it's using that in the car. Like you said, you know, we've got all these different brands. Volkswagen and Subaru are in there. Kia's in there. Maserati, Volvo. Some of those brands are not the fanciest brands. It's not like it's just Lexus, Mercedes, and BMW, and Audi. These are things that people can get their hands on with not a huge pain point in their pocket. And we're seeing the technology, just like when these phones came out, having a connected vehicle now can in many ways mean that you don't have to have the most fanciest vehicle around. Now, the big deal here is that Google will be issuing things like security updates and so on to Android Auto. And what Android Auto allows the user to do is connect their phone. They showed a cord, not Bluetooth, but that's fine because your phone needs to be charged anyway if it's going to be doing some work. And you're interacting with Android directly in the vehicle through the head unit, the infotainment system, your remote controls on your steering wheel. All that stuff is directly manipulating the data you want. We saw the user ask if a museum was open and then have the car navigate them there without having to think about, let me search it, what's the address, all that stuff. Google knows when things are open. I don't know about you guys, but I use Google Maps as a phone book today to figure out if some place that I want to go to is going to be open later, is going to be open whatever, availability, that kind of thing. So they use that functionality, and they used it pretty well. And then they showed that it wasn't about simply having Google apps run there, and it wasn't like the Apple TV, an embedded device running iOS, that in which Apple has had certain partners work with. Instead, Google Android TV allows, because of its SDK, third-party messaging developers, third-party audio developers, these guys can put their apps on the Android TV head unit in the infotainment system, and you can have access to this stuff just like you would any other app. So we're going to see some incredible growth, as it's not a super gated community. I mean, obviously, Google's going to go through whatever they have to go through to make sure these apps are going to be sound for your car experience. But we know already that Spotify, Songs, and MLB at Bat, these things are going to be on these cars when they roll out in late 2014 and heavily in 2015. So you'll be able to listen to your game via the internet, the connection on your phone, straight away. Spotify, the same thing. Get those playlists going and just keep on driving. And this is what millennials especially have wanted. As a person who worked in bringing radio to the smartphone, I got to say, the car manufacturers will talk to us and they would claim millennials aren't buying our cars. They want this small, Honda Fit style stuff. We're trying to sell big engines. We're trying to sell these like upgraded features. All they care about is if their phone connects. And you know what? That's true. All we care about is if our phone connects, because you want that level of data to be available to you. You don't want to feel like when you're in the car, you're separated from everybody else. But at the same time, we all want to avoid the problems with texting and so on. So with Google in the car, this Android, Auto, you're able to use voice communication for everything. You got a text message, the car will say, well, can you read it to me? It reads it to you. You tell it how to respond. And you move forward. You can connect phone calls. You can do all these things. It's not very different from Siri in the car, except for the fact that the third-party developers have free rein in terms of putting together applications and then having them updated. And that's one of the things that I think autos have really suffered from. You buy a Lexus today, you know, it's got a certain data in it for the GPS. In a year, that data is different. You've got to pay $200 in order to get that data updated. So.
You're stuck in the ecosystem of the individual manufacturer.
Exactly. Surprising that we didn't see Toyota, the largest car maker, as one of the partners on Android in the car.
I wonder if they have a deal with somebody else.
Some other large company that had a conference in Moscone.
They may, but I would say I'm going to wager that as a large car company that has incredible economies of scale, they can't simply turn this on the way smaller ones can. Now, VW and Audi is a very large car company as well. They're second largest. But I think that Toyota's a little slower to adopting this level of infotainment tech. With good reason. They had some quality issues back in the early 2000s, and they're very sensitive about changing.
Let's talk about Android Wear. So that's their OS for wearables.
Same SDK as Android in the car, Android Auto. Yeah.
And that was the other thing, too, is that they emphasize that they're trying to unify that SDK across all the devices, similar to what Microsoft had been talking about and had been doing with their Windows Mobile and Windows Metro and Windows the Windows Metro interface on the desktop and then Windows Mobile. They're trying to make it all basically one OS with different forward-facing interfaces depending on what device you use. And in this case, this is Android across the board for everything. It's the unification of the experience across all the devices.
Another example of the maturity of Android. Everything's going to touch. And they've done a pretty incredible job with Android Wear. And I say that as a Pebble user. I love Pebble. But I feel like, Andy, you saw some of this, and even you were kind of blown away as a Pebble user about how kind of functionality could possibly have you move away from Pebble and toward Google if it works out well.
Well, just on the surface of it alone, like, Pebble is impressive in what it does, but it is very sort of rudimentary at the same time. It's a two-color screen. It's limited in how it interfaces with your mobile device. Whereas what we see here with Android Wear, it's you see a nearly unlimited potential for watch faces and interfaces and interoperability between apps on the phone.
Yeah, so one of the things I noticed here, though, is my experience with Pebble has largely been with iOS, which means it shows me what goes on iOS. I don't really affect the phone too much.
Yeah.
I know Pebble on Android allows you to do things like communicate directly with the phone from the watch. That's a bigger deal. But what we see here is, instead of buttons, heavy use of touchscreen, which I don't think was possible on a device this small a few years ago in any meaningful way. The device also syncs directly with the phone. So right now in a Pebble, when I get a text message, my wrist will buzz and I will look at it. But that text message is still unread on my smartphone. It'll buzz again in 5 minutes, as is the default Apple setting. With Android Wear, when you look at that text message on your watch, it goes into the drawer, so to speak, on your phone. Mm-hmm. The phone knows what you've been doing with the watch, and when you're in certain apps, because there are apps directly on the watch, you're able to use the watch to interact with those services, and the equivalent client on your telephone will have been updated based on what you did on the watch. This is a big deal. The touchscreen, it seems to move pretty carefully. Obviously, like, it was a demonstration, and unlike some of the stuff we've seen from Apple, you'll see a hiccup here and there. But the best part about Google I.O. is that it's surrounded by developers, and developers know that these hiccups happen. The energy was really good. Health and wellness hardware support. So, again, what Google's doing is they're saying, hey, this is our Android Wear operating system. You guys go out and build it. Samsung, LG, Huawei, whatever. And they have the ability for those companies to support heart rate monitors, pedometers, other bits of technology in there that people might use when they're working out or doing other things like that. Obviously, they have the remote control of Android TV and Android mobile devices like you would have on a Pebble or some other device. But what they also have is voice recognition, and that's a new thing. This is the Maxwell Smart, the James Bond functionality where you can talk to your watch and get something out of it. That's kind of exciting. So they've got a few partners. LG and HTC have two square watches, and Motorola is coming out with a round one. The SDK supports both form factors, and we look forward to seeing them. The LG and HTC devices, again, were available today, while the Motorola device won't be available for some time, which is surprising considering that we heard about that one first some months ago. But, there's a lot of movement in this space, and Google is showing what can happen if you have full integration between Android on your phone and Android on your watch, as opposed to a third party that's just talking to you.
Yeah, no, it's pretty wild what they've been able to accomplish and the direction they're really trying to take the industry. I mean, not that I recall very much of you know, the 90s and sort of the technology around it. But for some reason, it just seems like we are getting really progressive in terms of like the new ideas and capabilities that are out there. Just there seems to be a lot of growth during, you know, the past, you know, 4 years, right? There seems to be a lot of pretty...
Once things get moving, they move pretty fast, is how technology usually happens. It's exponential growth. Speaking of progressive, though, one thing that really struck out to me was that, you know, we saw the Apple keynote 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we've, you know, we talked about Silicon Valley here on the television show, on the podcast, Silicon Valley television show here on the podcast. There is a predominance, especially when you look at some of the data that's come out of Facebook and Google, of, you know, certain demographics in this space. Mm-hmm. Speaking of progressive, at I.O.,
yeah,
you know, almost every single continent's native population was represented as either a leader or someone with expertise during this keynote. I saw people from all over the world, literally, not just Americans from different descents, but literally people from all over the world. And in addition, we saw leadership and expertise from females, which is not something that we've ever seen in an Apple keynote, ever. It's not something that we saw at all in the popular shows like Silicon Valley. And while, you know, these companies are working to actively, all of them, working to expand, you know, the amount of people from different ways of knowing, different backgrounds, different understandings in their organizations, Google did a very good job of making those people at the stadium feel like they were represented, because no matter who you were, someone like you was up there. It didn't matter if that person had an accent. It didn't matter if that person was on the business side, on the developer side, whatever. There was someone there for everybody. And it may sound on the surface, you know, superficial, maybe racist, whatever, but there is something to be said about the fact that these companies are chasing down different demographics to work in their organizations. And they have this kind of, that Google has this kind of representation on stage. The fact is, in order to get the best ideas, you need ideas from everyone, different ways of knowing, different walks of life. They can bring that to you. And I looked at Google I.O. and I really felt as if I was impressed. I was literally like, I was on Twitter. I was like, how do they do that? Because everybody and their mother's complaining that these people don't apply to the jobs, or these people aren't there, these people aren't whatever. But they were there in spades, and they all had something to contribute. And it wasn't just nominal. It was significant. And, you know, you got to applaud Google for that level of inclusivity when you're looking at a Silicon Valley that is constantly being berated for its lack of inclusivity.
Yeah, it's a meritocracy.
Yeah.
We hire and employ based on your merits and not on fulfilling some sort of quota.
Well, that's what we hope. One of the issues that's shown up in Silicon Valley is the question of, well, if you're a small company and you're going to hire people, if you're going to hire people just like you, that's going to make getting some things done easier. When I say just like you, you know, same cultural background, et cetera. Sure. And that's one of the things that's been looked at perhaps as one of the root causes of the issue of sameness. But what we see with Google is this kind of focus on actual diversity, not just, you know, we all look different, but we think the same. It's actual diversity of like background and understanding. I think that's what Silicon Valley needs more than just a bit of color. It needs people coming from different places to bring new ways of knowing to this technology that's emerging and changing so rapidly. The people with the best ideas are going to win, and by merging ideas from different places and different understandings, you're going to get those best ideas. So I think that's key.
Yep. Moving on here, Android TV. Oh boy!
I'm so excited about this one.
As they mentioned in the conference, Android TV isn't a device as such, but it's a focus on it's a new focus on bringing Android to the set-top experience. It's essentially an OS for third parties to create devices.
It's just like Android TV and Android Wear. It's a version of the operating system with an SDK that's designed to work as a set-top platform. And just like all those other things, Google's not interested in making the only device. They're interested in putting together the stuff together so that Sony, LG, and others can put together their own device. What's yeah. really interesting is while Amazon, you know, Apple's come out with the Apple TV 2 and 3, devices that really change this area. You obviously got the big guns when it comes to Microsoft and Sony with their PlayStation devices. But what Apple did was show that you could have a cheap device, Apple and Roku really, that got to all these services and got people around. Well, Amazon came out and they said, you know what, we can add games to this now because the technology is there. And they have selected friends that are putting together games for them. Google is doing something very interesting because they're the latest person at this party. They're the latest big player. They are behind the times.
Yeah.
I mean, but they're the first to actually have an open SDK that allows developers to put together whatever app they want for this TV platform. I think Apple developers, or at least Apple fans, have been hoping that Apple does that forever. But what Google showed us today was this set-top box that connects to the television set that was playing games. One guy was using a hardware controller developed by a manufacturer. The other guy was using his Samsung Android tablet to as a D-pad and controller to play the same game. And they were playing with each other. This is that kind of seamlessness right. that we're all looking right, for. Right. I mean, Apple showed this off in a very awesome way, you know, something similar in a very awesome way with Handoff when it comes to productivity and office documents. But on the fun side, the idea that any app could be suddenly made into an Android TV device. Now, that could make for a very messy interface if you don't watch out. But for the most part, that's what we've all wanted. We've all wanted that functionality, the fact yeah. that we spend something like 5 hours a day in front of the television set now that it's connected to YouTube and all these other things. That's great. But they got even bigger here. Not only do you get access to the Netflix and some of the other services, obviously Google Play, where your movies are going to be hanging out to purchase and rent, but they allowed users to talk to the device. Either through the telephone or through the remote controller or the controller or whatever, multiple ways to interact with this device. And what they did was they made it so that you can ask it, hey, can you find can you find this movie? Sure, it found that. Hey, how about a more abstract question? Can you show me the movies that were nominated for Oscars in 2012? All those films showed up mm-hmm. ready to purchase, rent, or play. And then finally they asked, hey, who played Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games? And there she was, Jennifer yep. Lawrence, with all the movies associated with her. Now, if you're like me and you do like the digital content, you like getting movies that are not just on a disc or whatever, you realize there is usually a missing component. Unless you're on HBO Go, you don't get any of the extras. Well, while Google doesn't give you all the extras, on the layer beneath your query sits the ability for YouTube to display related content, and that is pretty fantastic. So you're done with some movie that you were so excited about, and the fun doesn't have to end because you can go into these YouTube links that are attached to it and watch them all, you know, official interviews, things like that. And I think that helps expand the pie in terms of, you know, the way the user wants that meta content surrounding the actual content that we're all into. So I was really impressed with that aspect of Android TV.
Yeah, I'm excited about it too. You know, and once again, it looks like sort of the same kind of services as Google Chromecast. We've already seen with Google Chromecast because it is, you know, part of the same family. But it's nice to have sort of Android unification.
Yeah. So for me, one of the big things that excites me is that, you know, I've got an Apple TV and I've got a Sony TV that has Amazon streaming. I don't really use Google Play. Yeah. I only have one Android device and, you know, I don't use Google Play. But I can use Amazon for everything. So I tend to buy music on Amazon. It'll go into my iTunes. I tend to buy movies on Amazon because I can catch it on my iPad, my iPhone, and on my television set. Google's got Netflix set up already. I don't have a big list. I couldn't find a big list of what else they have. They didn't announce it. Now, if they could put Amazon on their set-top boxes, if the Sony products come out in 2015 mm-hmm. with Google, with Android TV built into it and Amazon built into it, it will pretty much have every service that I've ever wanted on a television set on one box to rule them all, so to speak. Mm-hmm. My PlayStation will play games and everything else I want to do, with the exception of the Disney stuff, will be hanging out on one set-top box. And that's pretty exciting because to date, one of the best interfaces has been Apple TV, but it hasn't had the Amazon stuff. Yeah. And while Amazon's Fire TV has some great features to it, there have been some complaints about how it works, its seamlessness, and its interface. So being able to get all that in one go on a Google device that's manufactured by Sony, who's both focusing on hardware and software, that to me seems like a pretty big win.
Right, right. Google, Amazon, they'll never handle Apple iTunes
content,
but there you go. That we know.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I've thought about that because Apple's always been kind of locked in. And with the exception of my Disney Movie Rewards program and whatever free stuff I've gotten on iTunes, I don't own any movies on. So I maybe own like 5 movies on Apple's locked in ecosystem. Everything else I've been using Amazon for, and I'm pretty happy with the fact that I can get to it no matter what device I'm on. If I decided maybe to move to Android at all, I'd also be able to get to all that stuff. So if Google has Android connectivity, that's going to be great. The problem with if Google has Amazon connectivity, that'd be great. Problem with Amazon's Fire TV is that all the apps are forked Amazon versions of Android stuff. So again, you kind of get locked in. If some new company shows up, you won't get access to other stuff in the Google Play Store. So you get the wide world of Google on an Android television set. And you may even get some Amazon content. That to me is a big win for consumers.
Did we talk about Google Fit?
Not yet. No.
So yeah, the Android with Google Fit is another one of the announcements that they made at the I/O conference, which is a set of APIs that lets app and peripheral makers feed data into a centralized fitness stream, and they've got some major partners on board, including Nike, and Nike's adding its Fuel number to the Fit stream so other apps can use it. So that's big news that Nike is going to be working with Fit as well.
Yeah, Nike's smart. They're going to get their service on as many devices as possible. Yeah. A tactic we saw from Netflix 5-6 years ago that has worked out incredibly well for them. 44 million users worldwide, with 4 million users more expected between now and September because they're on everything, and Nike is smart to move in that direction. Move away from the Fuel band, move into everything else.
Any other major notes from the Google I/O conference that we didn't cover?
One small one. Chromecast. It's not being abandoned. It's still there. It still works. $35.
God, I hope not. I haven't even opened mine.
Oh, wow. No.
I use mine like every day.
Yeah, I use mine a lot. Especially because it automatically picks up. It automatically changes my TV's input to it.
When I
activate it. But Chromecast finally has the ability to mirror what's on your Android device. It doesn't work for iOS.
Right.
But when Android L comes out, you'll be able to mirror your Android screen on Chromecast, which is something that it has been missing since it was released. As an Apple TV user who uses that feature a lot, the AirPlay. So that's a thing. And that's, I think, not a small deal.
Yeah. No,
it's easy. You have a USB port in your projector, right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, plug it in the or whatever you're using HDMI. You just plug it in there, hook up the USB port. That's the one thing about Chromecast. In the pictures, they don't show you that it needs USB power.
Yeah.
I had to go out and buy a super tiny USB connector so that it goes from the Chromecast directly into the USB port of my television set. But you know, super small footprint. Totally worth trying to hook up to your projector if you can.
Yeah. The only reason I haven't is because I have other services that fulfill everything that Chromecast does.
It does YouTube in a way that nothing else does.
Yeah, it's just so simple and easy to be like, push this to my TV.
Especially because if you use Chrome as a browser, that's where it really gets powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I had trouble getting I/O to play via AirPlay. I had trouble getting I/O to play on my iPhone. But when I loaded it up on Chrome and I was looking at the live stream and I pushed that via my Chromecast, it worked easily and in fantastic HD. So, you know, there might be some exclusive content regarding the way Chromecast is used. But out of the box, I haven't seen a better solution to getting YouTube Or even, you know, Netflix on Chromecast is pretty exciting too, because while your phone has to become a remote, which I'm not a fan of, it does a it's a pretty robust remote. It's not just simply the Apple TV remote, which is very simple. You get a lot of functionality, and yeah, I gotta say Chromecast is pretty powerful.
All right, so let's wrap it up for our Android discussion here and take one last break. And when we come back, how Netflix might be changing the face of late night television and our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini, here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Unifowaken. Chelsea Handler, after ending her 7-year run on E!, has inked a deal with Netflix to create a talk show to premiere worldwide in early 2016. But what Netflix isn't saying about the project is also interesting, according to Andrew Wallenstein in Variety. He asks, why on earth are they even trying a talk show, which contradicts some of the most fundamental assumptions about Netflix's programming strategy? It represents the diametric opposite of the content Netflix has concentrated on to date. It's known to be the most perishable of TV formats. You know, Netflix has, in their original content, they have focused on content that can be watched and rewatched. Late night TV shows have this sort of perishable end date. You know, no one wants to hear interviews with people talking about movies from previous weekends, or talking about or monologues about headlines from days and days ago. So the question is, what is Netflix's strategy here behind this?
I don't know. I mean, I look at this article and I see provincialism in its most raw form. I mean, good content survives. There's a reason why HBO has two talk shows and they're all on HBO Go for you to look back on. When you look at John Oliver, even if it's a week old, 2 weeks old, 3 weeks old, the content is good enough to compel you. And I think it's kind of silly to say, oh, well, it's not, it's, you know, late night, whatever. I mean, people DVR Jay Leno when Jay Leno was on. People do that kind of stuff. Now, I think that we don't know what she's going to do.
Yeah.
We don't know what Chelsea Handler signed up for. We don't know what she plans. She could be spending the next 6 months refining, figuring it out, doing whatever. But I do know that if you have any trust in what Netflix has been able to deliver over the last 2 or 3 years, it's worth keeping an eye out and looking into, because they've done some damn good stuff to change the way we look at TV. Mm-hmm. And I think late night is very ripe for these sorts of changes.
It's definitely a puzzling move, but you know, as kind of Dwayne said, in Netflix we trust, right? Like,
yeah,
they've been making a lot of positive moves so far. Not that we completely know the stats they have on viewership, or you know, if it is leading to an increase of money currently, or mm-hmm. if it's a long-term plan. But you know, so far, let's give them a shot and let's see what they come back with.
I think it's interesting, Dwayne, that you refer to the John Oliver project on HBO, because that is something that is again, that is one of those instances that unlike the Daily Show or any of the other sort of late night offerings, it is something that can be rewatched on HBO. It is a but also with John Oliver, it's he tackles topics that are not that are current, yet also in a way a little bit evergreen. He's talking about topics that are many years old in some cases, but are he's bringing them up as a topic today. And Chelsea Handler's show, her brand of late night comedy, at least up until this date, has been somewhat current, somewhat not evergreen. But perhaps she might bring something to the table that's more sort of variety, more skit based, perhaps.
Yeah, it's unclear. I do see what you're saying, and but when I look at this article, I feel like there's a reporter who wants to complain about a thing that hasn't happened yet, and that's kind of what bothered me a little bit as I drilled down into what he was trying to say. Chelsea Handler creates comedic content, and that content, even if it's a little dated, is gonna be funny if you're tied into that level of discourse. Now, we talked about how Android TV allowed you to find content and related YouTube content attached to it. Now, if Chelsea Handler is anything like John Oliver or anybody else,
yeah,
there's going to be a channel, and that stuff's going to be there. So when she's making a joke about a recent, you know, whatever, and you look up that actual content, and then you see her stuff on YouTube, that's also going to linger, and it's also going to be relevant. Social discourse is something that we all can't watch in the moment. I used to DVR, you know, late night TV, and to this day, I will go back and look at, you know, old.
But how
I'll go look at. I used to DVR because I couldn't. I wasn't at home at 11:30. I was out trying to.
I was gonna just about to ask you, how often do you go back and rewatch that stuff from?
Well, when I used to DVR late night TV, I'd come in at like, you know, maybe on the weekend I'd watch like a week's worth of Jay Leno. Because if you're a certain type of person. The kind of person that buys the Daily Show season pass, you're not going to watch it every day. You're not going to watch it every day at 11. You're not going to tune in. But what you are going to do is on a Sunday or a Saturday, you're going to pop it off and binge watch that half an hour, all four, I guess, you know, Monday through Friday, Monday through Thursday. You're going to watch 2 hours worth of Daily Show. You're going to understand what's going on in the world because you've been too busy to chase that down. And when I was younger, that's exactly what was happening with me. I was out having fun, you know, going, you know, trying to meet people, meet girls, whatever, you know, do business stuff. And that was keeping me from that level of, you know, zeitgeist and discourse, but I'd catch up on the weekend. In fact, the only TV show that I will watch when it actually shows up is probably Game of Thrones. And not because I really want to, but after about 3 or 4 episodes of not seeing it, I get bothered by the fact that everyone's talking about it, so I go chase it down. But we live in a time-shifted world, and Netflix understands that. So even if it's topical content, I think Chelsea Handler will have an audience. And you got to realize that what she's doing is so much less expensive than House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, Lilyhammer. So even if she only gets residuals for a month, 2 months, 3 months, a quarter, that's going to pay off when you compare it to the expense of building a complete fictionalized show.
Yeah. And the article points that out, like, even if this is a wash, it won't have cost Netflix anything for the experiment.
It just costs her salary and her staff salary. And, you know, frankly, if you're Chelsea Handler and you've been on, you know, you've been on cable for a long time, look at the size of the Netflix audience and realize this is a resume builder for you. Netflix is going to put this front and center when people log on. They're going to check out at least a piece of it. And if they like you, you're going to be set up for deals for the rest of your life, as opposed to, you know, one of the cable networks where only people who have time and have that channel are going to look at it. And in the age of cord cutting, I got to say, my cable box hasn't gone on since January, and it's, you know, June. I just haven't used it. And that's a thing. I guess I used it maybe during the Olympics, but I'm not really. I guess streamed from my Apple TV. So if you're Chelsea Handler, your agent's looking at you and saying, yeah, get on this shit.
Yep. Well, I'm actually excited to see whatever it is. I'll give it a try. Even though I'm not the biggest fan of Chelsea Handler as a personality, I'm willing to give it a try, and I'm on the just merely on the basis of I want to see what Netflix does with this and what this could mean. I mean, Netflix is a trailblazer. They are a
with the exception of Quixtar, they've been on point.
Yes, well, yeah, but
they Quixtar.
They are a barrier breaker, and I'd love to see what they have in store for this and see if the ripples then spread out amongst the rest of the industry, as most of the everything that Netflix has done, except for Quixtar, has shown. All right, let's talk about our drill down video of the week. This is Team Fortress 2 expiration date, and the reason that I wanted to highlight this is because this it's a 15-minute short produced by Valve and featuring their Team Fortress 2 characters, which are they've featured in a lot of little shorts before, like 2 or 3 minute shorts, but this represents the longest CGI short that Valve has produced as just a standalone short. And so it's worth noting that this is a full-on production for Valve. I don't know if you guys, either of you guys, got a chance to check this out.
Yeah, I mean, it looked pretty good. You know, I look at that kind of stuff, and all I think of, like, is when is Blizzard going to make me that StarCraft movie that I've been dreaming about?
Well, but also it represents like a potential for, you know, we're talking about all of these companies like Amazon and Netflix creating their own content. And I can certainly see Valve jumping on the bandwagon, particularly as they are developing their own Steam OS and Steam platform.
Yeah, as they move more towards the TV living room space.
Yeah,
they are the elephant in the room when it comes to the next iteration of set-top. I mean, they took streaming content to the next level when it came to their store. You look at the App Store, you look at the Mac Store, you look at the Microsoft Store. All that stuff came after Valve and Steam. And if they can figure out a way to get some good content, that's good. I mean, we've also seen Halo Forward Until Dawn, video game based, you know, film that was you know, pretty good looking.
There are two Halo projects upcoming that are tied to an Xbox Gold subscription.
Oh man, that's the kind of thing. If you're interested in spending that kind of money, that's called $60 to get some exclusive content, and that's totally worth it. So I feel like Steam might be able to pull that off. I mean, Valve might be able to pull that off. Again, Blizzard, give me my StarCraft movie. I want to see the fall of Kerrigan in all its glory.
Could be in the works for Blizzard, too. I mean, that's definitely a revenue stream for Blizzard, an untapped revenue stream for Blizzard, untapped revenue stream for Valve. As we're mentioning this, it occurs to me that I've already paid for a short that Valve produced already about the last... I think it was called The Last Days of Portal 2 or The Last Days of Half-Life 2. I can't remember. It was a documentary about the making of Portal 2, I believe.
Wow.
And I've already paid for that on Steam.
As long as you didn't cry.
Yeah, well. On that note, that is our show, with the exception of going around the room here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWAYNED. On Monday, I just recorded an episode of the Blendover podcast, so you can hear me there. Our friend Greg T. Davies, he says hello, Andrew.
How you getting along with Greg?
Wonderfully. We have a wonderful rapport. I mean, he's great. It's a very different show from the Drill Down, and because of that, you can kind of get into things in interesting and in other ways. So there's that, and then, you know, you can find, we did some writing on the Drill Down. You'll see some of that if you head over to thedrilldown.com, and you can always check out my stuff at dwayned.flavors.me. It's kind of my entire online presence. Tosin, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can find my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. And you can also find R2D2 stuff at toastr2d2.tumblr.com. Yeah. Probably a couple more weeks until I get a chance to update, but might do so while I'm on a plane. But did you guys get to see a little sneak peek of some of the dumb work that I've done?
I did, but now I'm having visions of R2 on a plane, like that Samuel L. Jackson movie. Sorry, man. Sorry.
Sick and fucking tired of these.
Andy, where are you online?
I am at basically, if you Google search for Mr. Baby Man, you'll find all of my social media links there, since that's my social media handle. Longtime social media handle. Facebook and Twitter at Mr. Baby Man as well. As for the drill down, the show itself, we are also on Facebook and Twitter. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, you can send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. As you've mentioned, Dwayne, we've published several of articles that you have given us for the site. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach a targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.